Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me again this Sunday night, the occasional to my constant, and the calamita to my calamar, it's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
Doing a bit better than I was last Sunday. I'm an additional week removed from my foot surgery, and it's inconvenient and annoying as hell to be trapped at home, but at least I'm not in remotely as much pain as I was a week ago. So that's a good thing.
That's a very good thing.
And I think it's like I spent the weekend watching a lot of like medical dramas that was making me feel so much better about my stupid little foot problem. So
so you weren't worrying if you had sarcoidosis or something like that?
Oh my God, I just heard that. Where did I just hear that?
House. They talked about it all the time on House, I'm sure.
Oh, by the way, because I did watch several episodes of House, it's funny. There was a running gag that was always on House. I should say this for the damn podcast I'm doing later in the week, but I'm going to say it now because you brought it up. So, we both brought it up. I seem to recall there was always a running gag on House where someone would throw out the diagnosis of lupus, and someone else would say, it's never lupus. And I actually watched 10 full episodes, plus a little pieces of a few others, of House over this past weekend, and not one of them mentioned lupus. And I was actually shocked by that, because I was like, wait, didn't they always mention... I mean, every other episode had the Everybody Lies line, because that's, you know, I mean, even my best friend has a t-shirt that says Everybody Lies, which is from House, whatever. But it's like, I didn't get one episode with lupus in it. Anyway, that's a conversation that should be for a podcast that's going to happen later this week, which I'll talk about towards the end of this podcast. The reason we are here tonight is to talk about the latest episode of Fargo that aired earlier this evening. It was the fifth episode this season, titled The Birthplace of Civilization. It was another installment written by Noah Hawley. I haven't checked. I'm wondering if he actually wrote all the episodes this season. I have a sneaking suspicion he might have until it's been shown to me otherwise. And this one was directed by Dana Gonzalez, who apparently is also going to be helming three more episodes this season. And he has worked with Hawley in the past. He actually directed a few episodes, I think two episodes, excuse me, of Legion back in seasons 2 and 3. That season 3 episode, I think you and I might have talked about it on the podcast once, now that I think about it. He's the dude who directed the one where they have to go back in time, and that's when he's going back to Morocco to fight Farouk, and what's her name goes back and tries to talk to David's mother in the past while the time demons are going everywhere. It's a good episode. Anyway.
Yeah, real good episode.
And speaking of really good episodes, I think tonight's was a really good episode.
Really good, and a whole lot happened.
Yes, I want to hear from those people, you know, who a few weeks ago were like, "We don't like this show. The pacing's slow. Nothing happens." You know, of course, they're probably not watching now, and then certainly not listening, because yeah, a whole lot happens. Also, thought it was interesting that outside of a moment in a hospital room and some headbanging, kind of a Orietta Light episode.
Yeah, very, very, very much so, and surprising that there was a little motion in that storyline, but we really focused on the gang war in this episode.
Which, by the way, I'm fine with, because I'm kind of... It's funny, you're dealing with a pretty much like a socio or a psycho. I'm not one to diagnose her. I don't know if she's a sociopath or a psychopath. I know she's a fucking Fruit Loop. But even though she might have more murders under her belt than most of these gangsters, she still seems to be more the comic relief of the season more than anybody else right now. Except for a few moments with Jason Schwartzman, one of which I think we'll be talking about in the next 10 minutes. I was fine to get a little bit of a break from her. As much as I do like the character, I think she's kind of fun. I am increasingly more invested in what's going on between, the Cannons and the Fadas. I love that that Holly had the nerve to just do like awful names and puns like that. Like, really? Cannon Fada?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
But I mean, it gave me a great intro to our first podcast about the show. So there's that. I mentioned you before we recorded it out, so I'll just start off right now. One of the things that grabbed me about this episode, Loy Cannon, Chris Rock, gets a number of really strong, good scenes, good back and forth confrontational scenes in this episode, to the point where I actually wondered, and I haven't read extensively about the behind the scenes about the season, and of course with everything with COVID-19 and how it impacted the season, who knows. I almost wonder if Noah Hawley wrote this part with Chris Rock in mind, or if Chris Rock was cast when they were only in the early stages, the first, may say, episode or two, and later episodes Hawley was writing with Chris Rock's manner of speech and presence in mind. Because there are scenes, I'm thinking specifically the scene with his wife. That could be Chris Rock on stage.
Yep, I thought the same thing.
I mean, the way he delivered and this is not a critique. It worked for the scene, but I couldn't help but think, it's almost Chris Rock's kind of being Chris Rock here. I don't mind it because it makes sense in the moment because he's getting kind of angry and argumentative, and it works because that's kind of part of his shtick when he's doing his some of his stand up. But I just felt that he has a lot of really strong scenes in this one, and I was really impressed by them. And I mean, we should talk about all of them, and I'm curious which one might have been your favorite, because I think I know which one I like the best.
That one stood out to me, and then on the provider I was watching it on, it showed that preview, the FX like fall preview that's been running for a while. Mm-hmm. And the quote, the pull quote in that preview was the roller coaster quote that he says in that scene.
Right.
That's the pull quote from Fargo they put in their sort of fall TV lineup, teaser or trailer. And I understood why, because it was, he showed a range, and I'll tell you where it really sounded like Chris Rock is where he said, "Now go get me my coffee." Like, the way he said that just mm-hmm. sounded so Chris Rock. Like, it was almost like a tagline on a bit that he'd done. But like you said, not to be critical at all, it was written and performed in a way that whoever wrote that, the way it was structured, uh-huh. sounded like something Chris Rock himself might have written and done in a on stage, as you said. So I really liked that scene, and I liked that, and it was menacing. It cut to the core of the story, but there's also the humor, the humor with the mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Where's your now? I just thought that scene in a way encapsulates everything you like about Fargo. That there's just a little hint of humor. There's a menace. There's a acknowledging a dark reality to what's going on in the world, and just a splash of humor. And that's sort of Fargo in a nutshell, that scene.
And I'll add to your list of things that make it very analogous to Fargo as a whole. That's a scene that seems like it's going to go in one direction and goes in a different direction. Because the tenor of the argument between Loy and his wife, she definitely sounds like she's the one in charge, and she's right, and she's leaving to get her son, whatever, and if she had just marched out, it was like, okay, that's the scene. He would have turned to say something to the mother-in-law, or whatever, and that's pretty much how I thought that scene was going to play out, and I did not see the tide turning on it to the point where she does take off the coat and go get him his coffee, and I went,
right,
whoa, but. And it was also interesting because you're listening to, you know, outside of, you know, the more florid language that they use, you know, she makes really good points, but then he makes better points.
And that's what I was going to say is at the point he's trying to keep his calm and she's winning the argument. Like the thing she's laying out, you as the viewer, you're on her side.
Right.
But then when he cuts through all the crap and just basically says, how do you think we have everything? It's this way and you're on the ride and now we're on the ride and this is how it has to play out. And when he just cuts through all the fakeness, all the artifice of everything happening and gets down to the bottom line, she realizes it's true. And you know, that you see why. And I did think it was interesting. He finally loses his cool. Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're fine.
Oh, sorry. I dropped one of my earbuds.
you're fine.
You can hear that he's trying to keep his cool with her at the beginning and increasingly loses his cool. But when it's over, like, he's calm again. And he gives the mother-in-law the little shot. And it just goes on. And it's not like, it's not terrifying, but you see in that flash why he's a boss and why he is where he is.
Right. And we're like 30 seconds from going over some of his other scenes. It is the one scene where he kind of does, his anger reaches that point. Despite the fact in several other scenes, it would have been just as justified for him to lose his cool, but like you're saying, he shows why he's a boss in those other scenes because he doesn't lose his cool. The only other thing I wanted to mention about the scene, because I mentioned it to you just before we started recording, I really, you know, I've got an ear for dialogue, you know, it's the so-called writer in me, whatever. And when they're talking about, you know, there's one son with the fathers, now the other son's in jail, and the daughter's up there, you know, and she says, like, pretty soon we're just going to have a house full of clothes. And I said, that's a great line. That's a really good line. But speaking of a scene where maybe he could have lost it, and he certainly didn't, and we learn stuff about two pivotal players in this season, in this scene, is the scene when Otis leads the raid on his warehouse. And we have that little kind of face-off between Loy and Otis. And when you realize Loy knows this dude's whole story. So again, it's what, and I always, I talk about constantly especially over the last 10 odd years, I'm talking to people about writing, about screenwriting, about whether it be films or TV, whatever. And we've probably had this conversation, maybe, and it's come up on podcasts before, I'm sure, I think. It's one of the key things to really great drama or great storytelling, a better way to put it, great storytelling is how you hide exposition or how you get away with exposition without feeling like, it's just exposition. This is total exposition here, but it works so well because it's the reveal and the way it's done and the reaction. And it's not just that we're finding out all about what happened to Otis as him being a minesweeper in the army and what went wrong and everything. The fact that Loy knows all this, that he knows this guy's story, tells us a lot about Loy.
Right.
Go on.
Also, the confidence with which he challenges him with the story, that the exposition hides within basically he's telling the guy his own story back to shit talk him in front of everyone.
Right. Absolutely. It's an unexpected, and again, we talked about how that scene went in a way that I wasn't expecting. I figured we were going to get Otis's story. The last person I thought I'd be hearing it from was Loy Cannon. So again, it's like, oh, wow. And especially within the confines of a raid on his warehouse where, you know, they're taking his men away and whatever. And, you know, boom, boom. Or is it boom? He kept saying, yeah, boom.
Yeah, boom.
Yeah, boom, boom, boom went to this, boom went to Colonel, whatever. So, again, another really strong scene with Loy. That was one of my favorites as well. Then one of the scenes were, oh, the funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
Funeral home. Mm-mm-mm. I love that plus, I like that earlier on in the episode, you know, people know stuff. People have figured stuff out already. Like, he knows full well that, you know, that we, you know, when he smelled the money from before, that, okay, it was these two who did it on their behalf, and then we find out that he actually knows who she is, and he even makes fun of her name. And it's like, really, if you're going to start making fun of her name, you've got a lot of people on the show you should be making fun of at this point. So, again, a lot of stuff we got in this episode, which is what makes, in a weird way, what makes the ending that much more tragic, is how smart and plugged in and aware Loy Cannon is of the people around him and the people in this town, which makes the end tragic, because it seems like he knows everything, but he didn't see this coming, you know?
Well, it's that classic, it's the introduction of a completely irrational actor that you can't account for that person, that right. When you have the irrational actor, that all your planning, all your knowledge doesn't matter, because that person will do something on a whim, and that changes everything and obviously sets us on a deadly course. And I also wanted to mention the things I saw in this episode and you know, Loy's stories tied into it, is this episode is like a bunch of near misses that like there, Otis almost runs into the Kellerman boys picking up the guns, but just misses it and shows up and just takes the bag of money. Had he showed up earlier, all those guns would have been taken out of play.
Right.
And also later we see Loy get, after the house, the scene with, you know, Zelmer and Swanee, that we sort of get Silence of the Lambs, that we think Oliphant's going to arrive, but Loy shows up first and he barely misses them. Deffy barely misses Loy and the you know, females leaving the hotel, and in an unexpected thing, we think, you know, there's going to be a shootout. He's going to come in. He's going to kill him. And he's already tactically thinking ahead. I want you to be soldiers, and you can either follow me or I'll kill you now. And, so his mind, the way that he played, he was the central role of this story. And I think they were preparing us for the fact that, you know, he's going to have to be his own best counsel. Because as we predicted, unfortunately, you know, our favorite person gets dealt with later in the episode. So, but I mean, he's the standout of this episode as far as I'm concerned, too, and got a lot to do with the story. There's also little bits, I like that he tells Zero, you're not, you know, he says in front of him, oh, he's not my son, in a rather harsh way. But then recognizes like sort of the meanness in that, and then tells, you know, I forget Ethelreda's mom's name. It's like Debril or Debril or something like that. But he tells her to go get him cake. And so, you know, he's a complex guy, and we see a lot of layers in this episode, and it was a standout episode for him for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think if there was something else I wanted to say about him because he mentioned. What's interesting, it's him, you know, he could be in a situation where he would be scrambling at this point, but up until what happens at the end, a lot of it is about he's asserting his position and he's fortifying it and he's laying the groundwork, you know, with the guns. And he makes a point of it being for loyalty because if they need more men, these are the guys they're going to call on. Whether they'll actually keep to their word or not, you know, the old, is there honor among thieves, especially when they're a different color, that will remain to be seen. And each of the scenes that we've talked about, the scene with his wife, the scene at the funeral home, especially where, you know, perhaps a softer or weaker man would have shown, more sympathy or empathy or which are one of those pathy kind of words. Because clearly he clearly knows that this wasn't a plan of theirs. Doesn't matter. It comes down to he was stolen from. Your sister's the thief, and then you paid me back with my own money.
Right.
They are lucky he doesn't actually. I mean, if this is Tony Soprano, they're probably dead. You know?
Right. There was a great line that I thought of, you know, when you were talking about loving and appreciate writing. There, what was the line he says? He said something to the effect of, like he's like, well, I don't know the rules. When the funeral homeowner saying, I didn't know the rules. It was my first time. And the wife says, well, surely there's something we can do. And he goes, no, this is the take the, you know, take, do what I say, or beg me not to kill you time. Like he just calmly says, like, this is when you should be begging me not to kill you because you're damn lucky I'm letting you live and you're going to be, like, I'm going to be your master, is what he says. Like, right. And which, you know, is terrible, but it's interesting that this is Ethel Rita's birthday, and he just missed her. She just left to go see them. Like, she's left the house. He shows up with her gone.
Right.
There are all these chance encounters that where people just missed that could have thrown the balance off.
And once you mentioned it, I started thinking about different things in the episode that kind of would qualify under what you're saying, because so you're hitting them, and or things where, you know, oh, that could have been a near miss. You know, you're lucky he didn't kill you because you were laughing at him. Oh, guess what? Doesn't like the coffee. Nah, he's going to kill you.
Right.
With Gaetano. Again, the wild card agent of chaos, whatever, however you want to refer to him in this, Gaetano. Well, it's really the two of them. You know, they're pretty much like the evil Abbott and Costello of this season or something.
Yeah, and did you get a sense in this episode? I did. I was just curious what you thought. I thought Calamita was like way stronger and more actively, like badass in this than in some, like when they went to do the hit, he kind of seemed like a dipshit and, Milligan stops him. Mm-hmm. I got the sense like being around Gaetano, like they're sort of symbiotically feeding off of each other's, you know, toxic masculinity, if you will. And like, he's really cranked up now by the time we see him here in a way we haven't seen him in the show yet.
I think the constant Calamita character, I think he's probably one of the more old school members of the Fada family organization, whatever. And I think it's a combination of things. I think definitely the more he's kind of positioned himself to be Gaetano's right-hand man and having that influence over him, because, you know, they're the two guys outside of maybe the consigliere who are really kind of even speak like they're fresh off the boat, quite frankly. And have that old school mentality of the way they go about things. But I think he's become more emboldened because he's been put in a position a few times over that he has probably shown him to be weak, that he feels has shown to be weak, like Rabbi Milligan being the one to stop him from shooting. It's like, really, that guy stopped you? That doesn't make him look good. Or then with the holdup and the guy, you know, puts the does like the cigarette lighter thing. It's the barrel of the gun. And burns his face, you know. And again, it's not, and let's be honest, especially it's 1950, but, you know, it's not just that some guy did it to you. You know, a black guy did that to you.
Right.
So now it's kind of like this episode is almost like his coming out party, which is funny because he also kind of scolds Gaetano after Gaetano shoots and kills the kid and the owner of the diner or the cafe or whatever the place was. And because he basically, hey, what'd you do that for?
Right. After the guy that Gaetano calls Chaplin, the kid.
Yes.
And that was another, I mean, speaking of, I mean, like probably some of the other best dialogue was, I thought Gaetano had some really good stuff in this. And the line in particular was where he talked about the difference between Italian Jesus and your Jesus.
Lady Jesus?
Yeah, Lady Jesus. That you know, in Italy, we have to nail Jesus to the cross because if we didn't, he would come down and kill every MF-er in Jerusalem. I mean, you know, a real insight into, you know, the organizing principle of this guy. And, those two characters drove what ultimately happened and set us on course. And it's funny, we've talked before. I asked the question, do you think like we'll settle the internal struggle and then go to like the gang war, or will it be in reverse? And it's a stupid question to ask. Both were wrong. Like, they're doing them simultaneously.
Yep.
And that made this episode made that abundantly clear.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I'm almost torn between, because as we sometimes do on these podcasts, once we've hooked into either a character or a specific set of characters, we kind of follow through with all their story in the episode before we move to something else. But do we want to talk about the ending and then bounce back to other things in the episode? I don't care. We've all seen the episode. It doesn't really matter. I don't mind doing that. Because the scene between Constant and Dr. Senator, and with Gaetano in the corner with his sundae, the guy who was knocking the idea of milk and sugar and coffee, and yet he's ladling in God knows how much freaking syrup constantly on that sundae,
and putting all the toppings and extra sugar on it, like everything you could add. Yeah, like after saying this is why America sucks because you put a little cream in your sugar. Or a little cream and sugar in your coffee, then he adds everything imaginable to the ice cream. Yeah, and, you know, really interesting racial things of, you know, making the black coffee less pure with adding that stuff and watching, like, the white ice cream be poured over with the, you know, fudge topping and the nuts and stuff. And, you know, really interesting commentary on how perverted your version of believing purity and superiority can be. Mm-hmm. And then seeing, like you say, even there in that diner, he's completely hypocritical about everything he said. And, you know, it's just a means to an end to justify what you want to do. It's okay to kill the bar guy and the kid, because you have some idea of the purity of what your values are. So it's really interesting stuff.
Oh yeah. He's named for the wrong family because he's the biggest loose cannon on the show. Obviously.
Yes, but, absolutely.
And then having his moment of, I mean, part of me was like, so basically we just went to, I know I'm watching something which is liberally and deliberately lifts from, you know, every other Coen Brothers movie, like every Fargo season does. And again, that's by design. But we just went Scorsese here because he might have a little been Joe Pesci, you know, shooting Spider or getting whatever. It really felt very Scorsese-esque to me when he killed, you know, the kid in the restaurant and the other with little to no provocation, just because he was just annoyed. It's also funny when we flip back or flip forward to that scene again with Dr. Senator. He's sitting in the corner and doing what he's clearly listening. And chuckling at certain things. He's even appreciating some of the humor of what Dr. Senator is saying. There's a certain point early on in Dr. Senator's dialogue when, and correct me if I'm wrong, I did not write a note about this in my little shorthand bullshit that I do for these things. He pretty much refers to them as children, doesn't he?
He says at one point, and I think it's the ultimate flip of the disrespect, he calls them boys. Which, okay. is the ultimate disrespect to, you know, call a full grown black male is to say, you know, boy. And that was commonly used as a term to put down.
Oh, he says you're just
black men.
Oh, he says you're just boy. Okay. I couldn't remember his child. Okay. Still works because he says that and he's sitting in the corner doing what he's doing with that Sunday, which is something like a little kid would do.
Right.
So
right.
I just thought that was so perfect.
And you know, that whole scene, I mean, when he walks in, the waitress tips him off that something's wrong. Yeah. And when he says, no, I don't want the coffee, at first I thought, is that a signal like she's going to go get a shotgun because of their exchange? But she's just passing on information, and he goes in and quickly assesses the scene and knows, who do I talk to, you or him? And really delightful. And you can see the thing that I thought was in his performance, Glenn Turman as Dr. Senator, is you could see in his face him deciding, do I want to continue to challenge or do I just back out of here? And as about as tactfully as he could, he continues to, you know, not back down, but stand his ground. I don't know that he would have walked out of there alive, because he's going to be he's the grenade to start the fire and start the war. Mm-hmm. But he still got his shots in without going far enough that had they been rational actors, there'd have been no way they could have justified just killing him in cold blood. So, I mean, great dialogue, great scene. And this is really, you know, the first time that we see Kalamita be somewhat formidable. But still in the end, Dr. Senator gets has the best of him, and he's clearly upset. And I was wrong. I thought Gaetano would kill him, but Kalamita does it on Gaetano's order.
Yeah.
I think they probably would have liked to have, you know, stabbed him or whatever, but they were clearly going to leave those bodies out as a message, and it was staged as a message, the ultimate indignity. I mean, if you think of everything we're talking about, what's, you know, the thing about Eric Garner, he was left out in the street for hours, right? Mm-hmm. Like Dr. Senator's body was left out in the street, and there's even the comment at the end of the episode where the crew says to Loy, like, man, we can't just leave him out here. Like, he's been out here. He's going to be out here. He's been out here for a while, and they have to leave, and they have to leave his body in the street. And I think one of them says he deserves better than that. Maybe even Loy says that.
Well, it's interesting because throughout the episode, Loy is not short for words.
Right.
And he asserts his position and is... even in the warehouse raid, despite the fact that all his men are taken away, that bag of money is taken away, and et cetera, still the guy in charge. Still the guy. Still, because he doesn't take him in. In retrospect, there's no reason not to have arrested him as well. Still doesn't. Because he's the guy in charge. And watching, this is the thing that happens in the episode that totally undercuts him and leaves him, you know, lost, at least in the moment. And it's, you know, obviously it's emotional. This is his closest, I think my interpretation is his closest friend as well, not just his consigliere. Even though I hate to say it, like, dude, you didn't see this coming? We all saw it coming. I mean, granted, right. because of who they cast, but still, we've been saying since, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, did we not say in the very first time we did the Fargo podcast this season, it's like, oh, he's going to die.
We achieved Scott and Brian's laws of television viewing, and rule number one is if you and I both universally love a character, they are in imminent peril.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What a wonderful performance. He's been a standout on the show. We've loved him. We've talked about him, and a sad end for Dr. Senator. And obviously, it's going to be the major precipitating action to all out war. Between the Cannons and the Fadas.
I'll never look at either doctors or senators the same way ever again. before we rewind back to other things about the episode, since we're talking at the very end, I gotta point it out. I love the fact, and it makes me want to go back to what I'm about to say. I kind of almost want to go back to previous seasons when an episode ended on like a notable, most likely a notable death or something of that magnitude, that they bring in the classic actual Fargo score at the end of the episode. I mean, that's the movie score, you know, and
right.
they don't use it that often. It's at least to my memory, you don't really hear that too often. I know it has been used before. And I think, do they choose to use it just when there's like something big and major like that has happened? I don't know. I'm curious. If I have spare time in the next week or so, I'll come through the episodes of Fargo, try to determine which ones end a certain way. And maybe I'll go back and check it out. Cause I have a suspicion they've done that before. Cause I remember when I'm watching it, like I recognized it right off the bat and I went, oh, that's the real Fargo. No offense to the great score they do for the show now, but that's the real Fargo music. Anyway.
It was noticeable, and it gave a very heavy sense of the loss to that scene. And it also, if I recall right, it also didn't end typically. It faded to black as the cars drove off and the lights went off of him, and as that music dropped. Great work, great character, and Dr. Senator will be missed.
Yeah, rest in power. Anyway. No.
Yep, absolutely.
Is that the thing people say now?
Yep.
I'm like the only one in the country who doesn't get the whole reference with RBG. And it's like, did I miss something? Did I miss a phrase somewhere? Is this a Black Panther thing? I'm not even sure anymore. Anyway. One last thing with Loy, how do we think the plan to recruit Bonnie and Bonnie, or I guess, you know, whatever, Solani and what's her name? Zinfandel? Zeldamir. Whatever. Some names are a little too cute for shoes here. Too cute for shoes. What the hell? Is this a good plan? Do we think they're going to do this?
Well, here's the interesting question. It certainly is going to be based on the conversation they have with Ethelreda about the difference between outlaws and criminals. They say they're outlaws, which means they don't play the game.
Right.
And Loy plays the game. If they go to work for him, they're no longer outlaws, they're criminals. Right. And they say, we're not going to do that. We're going to die with a gun in our hand. So either that's, you know, BS talk that when the time came, she quit reaching for her gun and went along with the plan, or they will say they're going to go work for him and play by their own rules, which I suspect they'll pull an audible based on what we've seen. But that whole story of are you a criminal? Are you an outlaw? Sets up an interesting thought process about watching what they do from that point forward.
Right. Of course, he does have a certain amount of leverage, because if they should do something, whether it be he or one of his men will probably then go kill her sister, her niece, her brother-in-law, you know. So that might be what keeps them in check, because there's no reason he wouldn't. Okay, well, guess who I'm going to kill now? That's what we do. You're going to have your family dead, burn house to the ground, you know. And they go all Al Capone on them. Okay. So I wanted to flip back to some of the Josto scenes, or Josto. Have we figured out how to pronounce his damn name yet?
Josto.
Josto. Just a little while here. I have to tell you what I'm going to talk about. So, because he's got some interesting scenes here, not really because of him so much. And one he kind of told, and then we're going to get to one where I say, you were doing so well, and then you kind of screwed it up. And then yep. You were okay again, but oh, if you hadn't done that, oh, you couldn't resist being a goofy douchebag just for the moment there. Really liked the scene early on in the episode when it's seen between Rabbi and Satchel. Lloyd's kid, and then Josta comes in, and they have the conversation. They're having a little conversation, because although Rabbi is obviously not his, you know, consigliere, Rabbi is also a pretty smart guy. They've been around. They were both involved in trades, if I'm recalling correctly. And I think basically what it comes down to is, you know, Josto's a little, maybe he's a little naive, thinking this plan that they've undertaken, you know, that's going to be enough to convince Gaetano to go home. And Rabbi's like, no. No. And he has that whole spiel about, you know, next week, you know, 10 men will come. I just like the whole thing about the math problem. You know, either you divide them or they multiply. And you realize that, okay, Rabbi's really attuned to what's going on here. And that's what's interesting is that the head of this family, there is, and I know it's not just by casting, it's the way the character is written. There is still so much of a comical side to him that you kind of wonder, is he taking everything as seriously as he should be as far as the magnitude of what's happening and what can potentially happen? And like I said, he undercuts it, because then we have that really, what mostly is a wonderful scene in the jail scene, when the first part of the scene, we're just with all of Loy's men, and his son is in there too, and people are talking about what's been happening, and how the guy who was supposed to be keeping an eye and driving Lemuel around is probably going to be in some serious trouble. At least he thought he was going to be, whatever. And then, you know, when the cops come in and everything, and I wasn't sure what was about to happen there.
The way that was brilliantly staged, that shot, because the way they lock the doors, leave the door open, and you're waiting somebody to walk in, they show the shot of all the guys in the cell. Mm-hmm. And it does have the look like somebody's going to walk in with like a Tommy gun and just mow them down. Like, It was shot that way. And then it's funny that it's staged that way, because then Justo says, like, you know, who's the one with the gat? And he pretends to shoot a Tommy gun at him.
And that's the one thing he does, which I think undercuts him in the whole scene. He comes in and he couldn't have staged it better if he was on Broadway. You know, he has Rabbi and the other dude come in before him, and he comes in the middle. So he's like it's like a procession almost. And it's one of the few times that when he walks in, it's almost like he has a certain amount of presence, which he generally doesn't. He's not an intimidating figure. Let's put it that way. And it's not just because he's short, you know, he's just not. But what he says at the start is like, oh, he's like as we've seen Lloyd do, he's asserting his position here, his position of power, and he is a man to be taken seriously. And then he does that rat-a-tat-tat thing, which just plays goofy. It just comes off goofy, and that's that's by the nature of that, the way that character is, and also the actor you have for the role. I mean, if this had been to use, just to go to a cliche, if this is a, you know, a movie where, you know, if De Niro in his heyday walks in and does that thing, it still has a kind of a scary feel to it. Or if this was if this is the 1930s and Edward G. Robinson walked into it and did that, it would still work. Justo by Jason Schwartzman, it doesn't. I know that's on purpose. I know, you know, I don't think it was a miscalculation. It's just, yeah, you kind of undercut. And then he does fine with the rest of it, but I kept thinking, yeah, it's, I kind of wish someone could say, you know what, you should probably shouldn't do the rat-a-tat-tat thing. It's probably, that's not going to work for you.
I thought that he was on the mark till the end, that he went too far, and that's his character flaw, is that he wants to be taken so seriously so much that he's so insecure he tries too hard. And but it has the classic line, I mean, great writing, like, you know why Americans love a crime story? Because America is a crime story. Like, you know, talking at something deep in the fabric of our, you know, of our country.
Oh,
and
all that was so good. It was so solid.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, you were making a point. You were on point. You were showing why, whatever. And then
if he just ends that by saying, look, nobody is going to respect you the way they respect me, but I'll respect you the way they don't, work, like, we need to make peace and work together. Like, that could have been the moment where he said, like, look, the system's rigged and I have power. And he's just demonstrated that by the fact the cops let him waltz in there and do this. Like, he's shown that he has power. If he'd have shown the least bit at the very end of that of, like, you know, humility, it may have pulled that relationship out of a tailspin, at least with those guys. But now they're going to be extra jacked up that you know, Dr. Senator's dead, with the way, with the tag he puts on it, you know, that says, you know, we need to solve this. In a way that says, like, I'm so powerful and I could have just killed you all. That's not somebody that's coming to you, you know, saying I want to work on this. It's somebody saying you're only alive because I choose to let you be right now. And that's, you know, the same thing, which if you think about it, is the same thing he did with Gaetano. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, I could kill you right now. The gun's on you, but I choose not to. Oh, that ought to be enough to hold him off. And we know clearly it's not. And and I thought a great little, to go back to the beginning of what you said, a great little thing was when Rabbi Milligan says, you know, you notice nobody ever says they're bad at language or bad at English, mm-hmm. but everybody says they're bad at math. And he's talking to the kid about math, and it's almost like somebody in power doesn't have to actually do the hard work of figuring out how it all works. They can just use words, and they don't really know what that equates to in the real world. That's what I took that to be, like a metaphor of, is that he can talk all this big game, but the actual math of we got to take these people out, the actual proving your work and doing the equation to solve it, that's what people don't want to deal with. They just want to say things. Right. Whereas Rabbi Milligan, you know, has done the math and said, this is what you have to do. Or, you know, he's not going away. And I thought that was a brilliant use of language to show, you know, Justo's lack of depth on what that problem was. So, you know, I thought really good scene. And I had this thought, and I'm curious what you think. After this episode, I've changed my mind. I don't think Rabbi Milligan is Mike Milligan's dad. I think Satchel's Mike Milligan. I think that the cannons are going to be wiped. The Fadas are going to be wiped. I think Rabbi Milligan's going to take Satchel. And he says, no matter what happens, I'll protect him. Right. And he says, and he tells him at one point, whenever the shooting starts, you stick close to me and I'll protect you. I think when everything goes bad, Rabbi Milligan gets him out, and he, you know, and he adopts his name.
Yeah. So he still is his father, just not genetically speaking, which then works better. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
And after watching this episode and what was said, that's what made me change my mind on that.
Yeah, that's a good catch there. Probably would have taken me another 2 episodes to even think of that, or if at all. It's one of those, once you say it, it's like, oh, yeah, it's got to be what it's going to be. Especially after watching this episode. Good call. Nicely done.
We'll see. I mean, Fargo's tricked us before, but I just thought that's where it pointed after watching this episode. So
true, but other than that one little thing with the gun running too, I figured they need to have a stronger connection to a previous season, and that would be stronger actually having him there as a child, because we know they've gone there before,
right?
Having a child. Of a character we see older in a later season. Actually, they've done it a few times now that I think about it. Let's see. What else? Well, Justo. Have we finished Justo? I think we have. I don't think there's anything else notable in the episode. Was there anything else? I feel like there's something I'm forgetting. Oh, you know, I haven't really talked about...
Deffy.
I mean, I know you... Dickware. Okay, so there's a few things about him I'm curious about here. And yeah, we didn't, I mean, I guess we could have talked about Ethelreda a little bit, especially because she's writing a letter to Dr. Harvard about Arietta and, you know, asking her dad about the laudanum, whatever. But my feeling is, since Arietta wasn't in the episode and that's really dealing with that, yeah, that we'll just wait and see how that comes, if that comes to fruition in a later episode. And I confess, my somewhat lack of interest in the two robber ladies is making me not care about talking about them as much. I apologize for my own meh-ness about that. You know that they're the Queen Maeve of this story, as far as I'm concerned. it's a boys' reference for you people. Oh, actually, yeah. I actually have an apology. I think I have to mention on a couple of podcasts to make a correction and apologize for something I said on the last Boys podcast, but I don't know if I should do it on this one or not. Anyhow, Deffy. Okay, so number one, we see that he sees Otis leave with that bag of money, right? We see that. Now, yep. Now, obviously, but he's also watching from across the street in his car, etc. No. I believe he knows that, to say it mildly, Otis is up to no good. I think that to me that I think that's already been. I think it's kind of clear that he knows he's dealing with, at the very least, a somewhat corrupt cop. Am I off base in that, or is everyone seeing that as well? That's not just
no. I see that, and I think he goes to Otis's apartment. And looks around and mm-hmm. doesn't see the money.
Yeah.
Because if he takes the money, he's just a dirty cop.
Right.
But if he takes it somewhere else, he's a bag man and implicates him in something bigger.
Okay. That's what I want to make sure we're on the same page as far as that's concerned. Okay. So he goes to his house. What is it with Hummels and TV shows and movies I watch? You know?
I had that thought too.
Is that Noah Hawley? And I was like, is Noah Hawley making a little nod at Better Call Saul? Or is he going way back to About Schmidt here? Because if people know the movie About Schmidt, and if you don't, you should see it. It's a good movie. Might be Nicholson's last great performance, actually. I'm not sure. Hummels play a big part in that movie. But it was interesting because that also gives us the two sides to the story. But in a way, it's kind of a continuation of Loy's reveal of Otis's time in the army and what happened and what apparently seems to have led to him to be the basket case he is right now. And the fact that kind of comes up to a certain extent in the scene with Deffy at his apartment when they're talking about, I guess it's his... the girl intended. That he left behind, or his intended, who,
yeah,
I guess he implied or says died rather horribly.
She was murdered. She was raped and murdered. And I wrote her name down, and I wondered if this name had ever been mentioned in the Fargoverse. And obviously, since we do this after the show, I haven't had time to look. But I'm looking through my notes here to see if I can find the name. It was an odd name. Nelson Beats was the raped and killed her. He got a letter in France. I thought one of the other things about this scene that was compelling was you see that what Lloyd said got to him so bad that, like, he had a bad night. Like, he either stayed up and drank or it upset him, that Lloyd bringing all that up messed with him pretty bad.
Yes.
And then, you know, normally he would probably tell Deffy to, you know, screw off, but Deffy then looks at the picture, touches the doll and sees he's upset, and then he tells the other side of the story, which I thought was really a nice bit of telling that story in two parts. I didn't expect to get the second part of that story in his room or apartment or house or whatever. I thought that was really nice the way they did that.
Agreed. I also love the and again, one of my favorite, if not my favorite combination on the show so far, is putting these two together. And I think they even riff on that where Deffy says something along the lines of we're partners, and he's like, no, we're not. He says something like, you've been here like for 25 years or something.
I got to name a street after you.
It was really, really spot on. And just because I like to step outside the show to a certain extent when we're talking about it with things which are, I always wonder, I'm sure that's just not intended or it's coincidental, but I also wonder if it's playing on it just a little wee bit. And maybe that goes into, again, the casting of the part. And at what point in the writing did he already know who the actor was to play the part or not? It's interesting to know that. And by the way, I know we've heard my cat a few times meowing in the background, like right now, and fire engines too. It's awesome.
And I'm hearing those sirens. It makes me want to say, come on, boss, we got to go. We got to go.
Yeah, it's New York. Dude, stop it. So I hate that cat so much. No, I don't. Well, I guess I do. Well, sort of. Anyway, that siren is not going to stop.
Okay.
So I
thought we'll just pretend we're the end of Fargo.
There you go. So I thought it was interesting because probably for many people, the role that they most know the actor Jack Houston from, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, he is, you know, part of the Houston legacy. So yay. I think he's Angelica Houston's son, if I'm not mistaken. I think he is. I'll check that out later. I hope I'm right about that. Anyway, love your granddad, dude. But he played a character. He played probably one of the most memorable characters in the entire run of Boardwalk Empire. Great HBO show about gangsters from, you know, taking place in the 20s. Who was a character who was horribly scarred from the war. To the point where, as if people haven't seen Boardwalk Empire, he was a character who actually had to wear a mask covering most of his face the entire time. Because of a horrible accident that happened in the war, an explosion, etc., blah, blah, blah. And it's interesting, we're seeing now this character, he's also a character who's horribly scarred from the war, from a different war, and it's more mental, not physical. Right. And, you know, having been a minesweeper, it's very interesting that his position was a minesweeper, and his main... The main manifestation we're seeing of his OCD that seems to have been more linked to post-traumatic stress disorder. I always get the letters confused on that. Sorry. Is the fact he has to tap so many times when he's, you know, his fight, which I think that's interesting. You were a minesweeper, and the thing that you're doing that you can't stop, your nervous tic is tapping on something over and over and over.
Right.
Which almost kind of, if you want to get like really ridiculously stretch it and make it really deep. Like, wow, there's something very self-destructive about your nature, because the last thing a mind would want to do would be constantly tapping on something, because that would set off a mine.
Right, but he says in the, when he's talking to Deffy, he says that the letter came, I always had a system, but after that I didn't care as much. And so I think that he always had OCD component that's been probably terribly exaggerated by the PTSD of what happened to his colonel after and learning of his fiance's murder.
I don't think you suddenly just acquire OCD, you know, like in your 30s or 40s. I think that it,
right.
But I think it's what you just said. I think that has exacerbated it, and it's almost like you're trying to make up for the fact, as you say, that he went off his system because something happened. He was emotionally affected by it, and you know, although it's interesting because that's the version we're hearing from him, which may very well be the true version. Because if we were going by Loy's version, he was pretty much a screw up from day one as a mind reader, because people sounded like people were getting blown up right and left. That was
right.
You know, probably an exaggeration, but the, as you say, the fact that Loy knew all this and told it in such a way has clearly gotten to him more than anything else we've seen on the series so far.
Yeah, and I like that Loy even showed off in that scene and says, you just reminded me of when you said that. He said they had to send his colonel back in a turpin, or the word he uses,
terrain.
And then he explained terrain, yeah. And he had to explain what that word was. And I'll be honest, when he said it, I was like, a terrain? Like, and then he says, you know, like it's a pot used for soup or whatever. And so he even shows off his intellect to let Otis know, like, look, you know, you're not dealing with somebody dumb. I know a lot about you, and I'm a smart guy.
You know what's funny? I think in one of the early reviews I read for the series back when it first premiered a few weeks ago, I think there was one review I read or a critic I read who actually cited that as something that they didn't like. They thought that was a bit much, to define terrain in the scene, whatever. It's like, okay, we're being, what was it my teacher used to say? Well, gilding the lily there. It was like, that's a little much. I personally didn't think it. I thought it was fine. But I could see where someone would say that. I thought it worked. And look, you weren't sure what it meant. So there, it worked. Fine.
Exactly.
So back to Deffy. Because we got that little unexpected in the moment scene when he goes to the school to see Ethel Rita. And where we finally get the actual title of the damn episode, where the birthplace of civilization, where that phrase is actually used in the episode. But it was interesting because, you know, I like that they did the jump cut there.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's, you know, he's putting it to her. It's like, well, you know, either because he wants the information for where her aunt, her aunt would be right now. That she would say aunt, he would say aunt, I'm sure. It's just the way that people speak. You know, someone's life is going to be going down the tubes. They're going to get screwed up now. And then, you know, they cut. Obviously, she has given him the information. I'm always going to be a sucker for Timothy Oliphant if he's wearing like a big hat and he's a lawman anyway. But I don't care if this is just basically kind of just a riff on what he's done before. I'm fine with that. It's still fun. I'm really enjoying it, you know.
And it's super fun to watch him not curse and say like son of a biscuit and, you know, be at least in his mannerisms, not as flawed as some of his other characters, but basically at his core, still a somewhat flawed person based on the times he lived in. And, you know, I thought that was a great scene to illustrate what sometimes is the power of the criminal justice system. And even then against, you know, somebody like Ethel Rita, where you see just him showing up makes everybody mad that here's a law enforcement person here. And But to say, like, somebody's life's getting ruined, it can be yours, it can be hers. And, you know, like, now she obviously told the truth, but you could imagine that kind of choice would lead somebody to give information whether they had it or not. Like, I'm going to ruin your life or theirs. That's a pretty easy binary choice to make. But, you know, she does catch on. And you know, I thought in the way this show's so subtle and touches these issues, the idea of what being civilized means and to suggest that if you're black and you don't cooperate with me, the white authority, in the way I want you to, that shows a lack of civilization.
Right.
That's, you know, the ultimate othering. It's almost like the, hey, you know, you're not protesting the way I like you to protest. So, you know, if you did it this way, I would be on your side, but you didn't do it the way I liked. And because of that, you're not civilized, you know, you're like an animal. And pointing that out and her being able to stick in his face, you know, it is funny. If you think about I just thought of this. If you think about him through the season, he pulls out carrots and eats, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, and it's like, so he's like a carrots or stick guy, and he goes with the stick with her eventually, like, and threatens her. And I know that's a silly thing to say, but it just popped in my head that, like, he threatens her and then they do the great jump cut, and then he rushes and we see the, you know, the two women be spirited away. And but they do, like, I guess the last thing we see is he runs up and busts in and says, son of a biscuit. But when he was running up and busting in, we're thinking who's going to get there first. And we don't even know Loy's headed there. At least I'd forgot, because it had sort of left somewhere in the story. And so when the door kicks in and it's Loy, it surprises you. It's the Silence of the Lambs switch. But,
right.
You know, I love Duffy. And I think there's a sophistication. He presents the all shucks, you know, just a simple Utah lawman, but he's sharp. He's watching. He's seeing what's going on.
See, I thought you were going to say something. Well, he's always eating carrots, so he must have really good eyesight, so he should see clearly. That. Anyway, with that, I'm clawing a halt to this Fargo conversation.
Fair enough.
So. And because I do have a couple other things to say, but I'm going to wait till after the wrap-up, which I'm going to start now. If you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Fargo, The Boys, and whatever else we're talking about or not talking about. Bring up stuff yourself. You know, we'll talk about it, maybe. I mean, we have at least 3 or 4 people talking on that board. You never know. And I'm going to murder my cat after this podcast is over.
Dude, seriously, I'm right here. Go, get out of here. Go.
He's just, anyway. 1, 2, 3. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to our feed, and you can rate and review us there. I've not checked in a long time. I wonder if we've gotten any new ones. I'm going to say no. You can go to our podcast host, where all 277 of our podcasts can be found to listen to at your leisure. Or if you're, you know, holding someone hostage for several weeks and you want to torture them, you can play. I can name a few that might be worth it. Oh boy. That podcast page is stvdpodcast.podbean.com. That's where you can find all our podcasts. Heck, just Google STVD Podcast or Serious TV Drama Podcast. You'll find us on a bunch of other weird sites. I don't even know why they exist. I don't know where they're making money from. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. We do tweet every once in a while. Sometimes we accidentally tweet when it's supposed to be someone else's personal account. It's crazy that happens. our Twitter handle is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. Okay, so that wraps up tonight's podcast about Fargo. The next podcast that will be coming forth upon this feed will not be The Boys. Gus, we finished that last week. And if you're a fan of that show, why aren't you listening to that podcast? Because I just assume you're not. I don't know. And it's not going to be Fargo. It's actually going to be the much hyped, just by me, because no one else cares, series of podcasts, which is going to kick off this week, which is ever so mildly and subtly and, you know, diminutively titled The Greatest TV Drama Episodes of All Time. It's going to be a series again of 20 podcasts, you know, because we're counting down from number 20 to number one. We start this week, which means we're probably going to end sometime, I think, March. I think that's how it works out, if I'm not mistaken. So I've already announced it on Facebook, but if you happen to be listening to this podcast and you're not on the Facebook or the Book of Face or whatever we call it now, the show to watch, number 20, is going to be an episode of House. Yes, House, the show with Hugh Laurie that was on Fox, you know, 10 years ago or whatever the heck it was. The episode is from season 4. It's titled House's Head. I believe it's the 15th episode of that season. If you do want to check it out, you can find all of House, actually, on Amazon Prime. And if you don't have Amazon Prime, come on. Why don't you have Amazon Prime? You get the free shipping if you do that. Come on, get Amazon Prime. Brian is actually going to be on one of these podcasts, but he's not going to be on that one. I do plan to have a series of revolving or different co-hosts whenever possible. So, yes, Brian has agreed to do one. I'm telling you right now, he's probably going to do at least a few, as will Jamie. But we're also going to bring in some other talent as well, folks who have appeared on the podcast years ago, maybe once or twice. There might be a newbie in there. I believe I've got nailed down a commitment from someone who's only appeared on the podcast once, even though that podcast isn't going to be till like late January, but he's already said he'll do it. The person who's going to be podcasting number 20 with me, it will actually be Kelly from some folks might know from the Geek Girl Soup podcast. I think she last appeared on our podcast. When me and Dan were covering Mad Men season 2 back in 2015. So yeah, what, 5.5 years ago? Yeah, so that's about it. So look out for that podcast. It'll pop up in your feed. And if you don't like the shows and how they get ranked, I don't care. No. Well, I'll talk about it on the podcast. And, you know, many different calculations and permutations were done to come up with this list. And like the nature of all lists and countdowns, no one expects everybody to agree with it. I would be shocked if anybody agrees with it. As long as we just have fun, healthy, don't annoy me debates about it, that's fine.
Exactly. Have fun with this is not the people's list. This is Scott's list.
Well,
the people can debate and talk about it. This is Scott's list.
I don't want to say it's my list per se, because again, if my personal top 20 would not be this 20. So that's why I wouldn't say it's my list. It's a culmination of things. And then, as I said somewhere, perhaps I just insert a little of my own je ne sais quoi into the mix.
It's okay. It's your curated list.
Yeah, okay. I'll
go based upon other bits of information and data. So just right. Have fun with it and don't take it too serious, folks.
Exactly. I'm basically like the guys who run the numbers and analyze, you know, the sabermetrics for baseball teams. We don't actually have to explain the shit to you. Just
exactly.
Just live with it. You know? Oh, wait, that's not the episode you would have picked of blah, blah, blah. That show shouldn't be on the list. And as I said to two people already, you know what? Go get your own podcast and then you can do your own list and shut the fuck up.
And again, flame throwing out of the bullpen.
There you go.
Big right hander.
And as you were saying earlier, I think we were talking about potential audio issues, whatever. Anyone else who complains about it, all I'm going to say is like, so how much are you paying for this podcast? Shut up. Do you know?
We do our best.
You know, I've wanted to do a GoFundMe for the podcast, but, you know, I go on GoFundMe and people are trying to, like, raise money for, like, cancer surgery or, you know, their cat lost its tail or whatever. And I'm like, I'm going to raise money for a microphone and paying some subscription fees? No, I'll figure out a way to do it. Anyway, with that, Brian, Thank you so much for joining me this Sunday night to talk about Fargo. And look forward to talking to you next week.
Really great. And I want to add saying two things real quick. One is I was excited to see season two of The Outsiders. Or The Outsider has been renewed by HBO. That could be really terrible. The Stephen King based show. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to see that get a second season. And the second thing is if you have access to HBO, watch American Utopia. It's amazing. The David Byrne Broadway play, filmed by Spike Lee.
Yep.
Really awesome. I checked that out and it was awesome. So check that out, everybody. Have a good week, and we'll see you next week.
Good night, all.